Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Seems like I've seen some of you folks recently. Yeah. Just couldn't wait to get back to see you again. No, it is good to see you, of course, as always. When we were in the book of Acts the last time, we finished chapter 11. And we'll go into chapter 12 today, but before we do, I'd like to just take a look once again at the end, the very end of chapter 11, the last three verses there, four verses, starting in verse 27. So it says, "Now in these days prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. And one of them named Agabus stood up and foretold by the Spirit that there would be a great famine over all the world. This took place in the days of Claudius. So the disciples determined everyone according to his ability to send relief to the brothers living in Judea." Remember, they're in Antioch and they're going to send relief to the Jerusalem church. "And they did so, sending it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul." We closed with that for the last time. Now, what I want you to do before we begin in the first verse of chapter 12, I want you to look at the very end of chapter 12, which says, "And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had completed their service, bringing with them John, whose other name was Mark." So at the end of chapter 11, we read that Barnabas and Saul were going to Jerusalem, going to Judea to take what had been collected for the people there due to the famine. And then here at the end of chapter 12, you see that they returned from Jerusalem. So they made the trip. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the contents of chapter 12 happened in a different frame of time than you might think. You might think when they left, then the things in chapter 12 happened, and then they came back. But no, this is out of chronological sequence, because what Luke is doing here, he wants to inform his readers of the things going on in Jerusalem, and that there's still a viable work going on there. The word is still being preached. God is still active there. It's not as if he had abandoned the Jerusalem church, because now more and more you will notice he's turning his attention away from Jerusalem. In fact, take a look. I just want to read through this in Acts chapter 12. Before we will read this today, but after chapter 12, you notice it talks about the Apostle Paul, his conversion and so on, how he became an apostle, and the difficulties he went through and the difficulties the church went through as a result of this former persecutor of the church now becoming one of them and a leader among them at that. But then you will notice that here in chapter 12 he talks about Peter and the Jerusalem church. And then at the end you're back to Paul and Barnabas when they returned from their trip. And then if you went through, I'm just going to go through the subsequent chapters from chapter 13 onward and read a few of the subheadings as they appear here in the English Standard Version. Chapter 13, one of the subheadings, Barnabas and Saul at Cyprus. Paul and Barnabas in Antioch of Pisidia. Another subheading, Paul and Barnabas at Iconium. I'll just read on through. Paul and Barnabas at Lystra. Paul stoned at Lystra. Paul and Barnabas returned to Antioch in Syria. And then you have the account of the Jerusalem Council in chapter 15. And then right away, Paul and Barnabas separate. Timothy joins Paul and Silas. And then you have Paul and Silas in prison. And then you have Paul and Silas in Thessalonica. Then Paul and Silas in Berea. Paul in Athena. Paul addresses the Areopagus. Paul. All the way to the end of the book, it's Paul. This is kind of odd, because you have all these gospel accounts where you have Jesus training and teaching the foundational pillars of his church, the 12. It's always the 12, the 12, the 12. And then you begin in the book of Acts, you see those same men, minus Judas, of course, replaced by Matthias. But Peter stands up and preaches. And then you see the work that's going on there in Jerusalem. And now then, he's shifting gears away from Jerusalem to the ministry of Paul and the rest of the book of Acts from this point. After chapter 12, it's all about Paul. We do get a little glimpse of the Jerusalem church and what Peter and the others are doing. But for the most part, it is the journeys. It's the missionary work, if you want to call it that, the evangelistic work of the Apostle Paul and those people associated with him in his ministry. So it's very interesting that here you have this one who was called, as it were, out of due season, and now the focus turns to him in this book of Acts. And also it's equally interesting that most of the New Testament, the New Testament epistles, were written by the Apostle Paul. And that's why some of the more liberal theologians would say, well, you know, Paul introduces this new thing called Christianity, but the original faith was not Christianity. Well, that's a bunch of nonsense, of course. Paul and Peter taught the same things. It was the same faith that they both proclaimed. But let's take up this account in chapter 12, and I want to show you why we know that this is chronologically out of sequence. The events of chapter 12 actually happened before Paul and Barnabas were sent to Jerusalem with the supplies that the church had gathered for them. The reason we know this is because we're told in, look at verse 1, says about that time, notice it says about that time, not exactly that time, about that time, the same general time period, could be, you know, separated by a few years. About that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. This Herod is Agrippa the First. Now, Agrippa the First died in A.D. 44. Okay, keep that dated. A.D. 44, that's when he died. But here he is, alive and well, and he's mistreating the church. He's laid violent hands on some who belong to the church. And then it goes on to say he killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. Probably by beheading, because that's what apostates got in those days. But here you have Agrippa the First, who died in A.D. 44. And yet, remember, Paul and Barnabas were sent to Jerusalem because of the famine that was there. Now, when did this famine occur? Well, we know from secular history, particularly from the writings of Josephus, that this famine took, there was a severe famine between the years A.D. 45 and 47. Remember, Agrippa dies in 44. So that tells you this account here in chapter 12, where it begins by telling us that Herod, or Agrippa the First, was laying violent hands to some who belonged to the church. We know this happened actually before Paul and Barnabas then were sent to Jerusalem. So even though it's out of chronological sequence, there's a good reason for Luke including this. And one good reason, probably a number of good reasons, but one good reason is that he knows the story is shifting now to the ministry of the Apostle Paul, but he wants his readers to know that God is still working at Jerusalem. And you're going to see that in this account. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and read this. Read verse 1 again. About that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. Again, we've identified him as Agrippa the First. He killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. Now, he was one of the original 12. So here's yet another martyr in the church. And we know from secular sources, as I mentioned earlier, that apostates, in fact, murderers and apostates, were generally executed by beheading. So what this probably means is when it says killed with a sword, means he was beheaded. And when he saw it, that it pleased the Jews, this is talking about Agrippa, when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. You see, he wanted to appease them because there's a very good reason for this. Anything that pleased the Jews, he wanted to do it because the Jews hated his family. So that's why when he was in Jerusalem, not when he was in Rome, but when he was in Jerusalem, he himself acted as an observant Jew. And he tried to appease the people. He tried to gain their support. And so here they see he does something, and the Jews like it. They're talking about the unbelieving Jews, because remember, at this point, the believing and unbelieving Jews, there was contention developing between them, the church and the rest of the Jewish population, in other words. A lot of contention had developed there, and partly due to the religious leadership of that time. So here we have Agrippa going now, having killed John, James, the brother of John, and now he arrests Peter. And it says, this was during the days of unleavened bread. Now, this is very important because we know that a huge crowd of zealous Jews would have been there during the feast. Because they came, that's one of the pilgrimage festivals, and they would have been there in great numbers. And so it was an opportune time for Herod, Agrippa the First, to carry out these acts that would please a larger number of Jews so he could win their support. I mean, he was a politician, after all. That's what politicians do. They want to win the support of the people who are under them. And when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover. Now, this is interesting. The word Passover is used here. It shows us that since it was during the days of unleavened bread when he was arrested, and then intending after Passover, this shows us that by this time, and no doubt before, the word Passover was not used only of the sacrificial rite on the 14th day between the evenings, but the whole feast was called Passover by this time. So intending after the Passover to bring him out to the people. Now, then he'd be put on trial, and guess what would happen to him? Same thing that happened to James, the brother of John. So this is what his plan was. It wouldn't be a good idea to carry out this during the Passover festival, so he's going to wait afterward. So Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. And we see again and again in the book of Acts this association between the church's prayers and divine activity. Shows us there is obviously connection there. We saw it back in chapter 4, you will remember. When Peter and John were threatened, they came to their own company, the church, and they prayed, and the place was shaken. You recall that. So you have divine activity becoming evident in association with the church's prayers, and we're going to see that once again. And yet there's some interesting things that happen in this regard. Verse 6, Now when Herod was about to bring him out, on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers. Now, notice how carefully he was bound and guarded. He was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. Two soldiers, two chains, and then sentries. Is he going to get out? Doesn't look like it, does it? They wanted him to stay in there, didn't they? They intended for him to stay put. And then it says, and behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone on the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, get up quickly. And the chains fell off his hands. We see that happening elsewhere to another apostle. And the angel said to him, dress yourself and put on your sandals. And he did so. And he said to him, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. And he went out and followed him. He did not know that what was being done by the angel was real. You know, you wake up out of your sleep and you're in that groggy state and, you know, you put your clothes on. We're going. And you do it. And he wasn't sure. Am I dreaming? Am I having a vision? He thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened for them on its own accord. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel left him. When Peter came to himself, still a little groggy, I suppose, he said, "Now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." So here finally he realized, hey, this is real. I'm really out of there. But again, I emphasize that he had all these guards and sentries and chains to keep him in place. And the angel shows up and leads him out of there. When he realized this, verse 12, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So here they are, praying. Praying for what? Obviously, praying for Peter's deliverance, among other things, I'm sure. And when he knocked at the door of the gateway, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice, in her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. Now here are these people praying for Peter's release. Oh Lord, release your servant. So when Rhoda goes in and reports this, they said to her, "You're out of your mind. Now then, let's get back to praying. Oh Lord, release Peter from prison." But she kept insisting that it was so, and they kept saying, "It is his angel." The word means messenger. They could have had in mind, I suppose, some kind of messenger from Peter. Or they might have had, you know, there was this idea then among the people that everyone had a guardian angel. That's still a common belief in the world today, that everyone has a guardian angel. And that the guardian angel sometimes assumes the appearance of the person that he is guarding, or he's helping, or he's assigned to. And it may be that they thought that that's what this was. But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. Because all they'd been doing is praying for his release. But now they're amazed that he is released. I guess it's something they didn't expect, even though they were praying for it. You know, I think we can relate to that, maybe. I mean, most of us probably can. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, "Tell these things to James and to the brothers." Then he departed and went to another place. Now, where do you think he went? There's been all kinds of speculation about this. But probably the best guess is that he went to Antioch of Syria, because when you start putting a little pieces and bits and pieces together, you find in different places in Scripture and see where Peter was on this occasion, Paul was on the other occasion, and it's not altogether clear. There's no, you know, you can place it on a chart, flow of time, and try to figure it out, but probably the best guess is he went to Antioch of Syria, and this is where in Galatians 2, you will remember, that the Apostle Paul confronted him to the face. Here's a guy been released, miraculously released from prison, and now he leaves. He goes up to Antioch, if indeed that's where he went. And that's where he's eating with the Gentile converts until some people from Jerusalem, from James, come in, and they're observant. They're converts, but they're still observant Jews. And he sees them, and out of a little bit of worry there, he gets up and removes himself from the Gentile believers. And that's where Paul publicly rebukes him. He ought to know better than that. But anyway, that's in Galatians 2 in verses 11 through 14, if you want to read that. And this is probably where he went. Now, verse 18. Now, when day came, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers over what had become of Peter. I can imagine so. Where is he? We had him tightly bound. He was here. No way he could have gotten out, and yet now then he's not here. You can imagine how they must have felt. Plus, knowing that what was going to happen to them now. And after Herod searched for him and did not find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be put to death. You see, that was Roman law. Roman law stated that a guard who let his prisoner escape was subject to the same punishment due to the prisoner. And knowing that Peter was going to be beheaded, as James, the brother of John, had been, then these people probably got the same kind of treatment. They were put to death, in some fashion at least. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and spent time there, talking about Herod, or Agrippa the First. And on verse 20, now Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. The reason is unstated. There's nothing in secular history, nothing in Josephus that would indicate as to why. But he was angry with them for some reason, some unstated and some unknown reason. And they came to him with one accord. That means they no doubt sent a delegation to him. And having persuaded Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they asked for peace. Now why? Why would they want peace with this man that really in their hearts they despised him? They despised his family. Because their country depended on the king's country for food. That's why. On an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robes, took his seat upon the throne, and delivered an oration to them. And the people were shouting, "The voice of a God and not a man." And he loved it. He liked it a lot. In fact, I'm going to read Josephus' account of that. He does record this event. Obviously, they were trying to appease him by heaping praise on him. And he liked it very well. He glorified himself in it. He did not glorify God, though, did he? No. It was all aimed at him, focused on him. And there were consequences to be paid. It said, immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give the glory. And he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. Now I want to read from Josephus. This is, comes from Antiquity of the Jews, book 19, chapter 8, and paragraph 2. Antiquities of the Jews. Josephus writes, now when Agrippa had reigned 3 years over all Judea, he came to the city Caesarea, which was formerly called Strato's Tower, and there he exhibited shows in honor of Caesar upon his being informed that there was a certain festival celebrated to make vows for his safety. At which festival a great multitude was gotten together of the principal persons and such as were of dignity through his province. On the second day of which shows he put on a garment made wholly of silver and of a contexture truly wonderful, and came into the theater early in the morning, at which time the silver of his garment being illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays, in other words, the very first rays of the sun that peeks through, and they, when they hit the garment, it was like he was glowing. Illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays upon it, shone out after a surprising manner, and was so resplendent as to spread a horror over those that looked intently upon him. In other words, you couldn't just stare straight at it. It was hard to look at because it was so bright. Now, what do you think he was going for here? The look of a god. And presently his flatterers cried out, one from one place and another from another, though not for his good, that he was a god. So Josephus' account here confirms the New Testament account. And they added, "Be thou merciful to us, for although we have hitherto reverenced thee only as a man, yet shall we henceforth own thee as superior to mortal nature." In other words, we'll now acknowledge you as a god. And of course, he loved it. Upon this, the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery, though he didn't, because he liked what was being done there. It looks to me like that's what he was going for. That's what he wanted. But as he presently afterward looked up, he saw an owl sitting on a certain rope over his head, and immediately understood that this bird was the messenger of ill tidings, as it had once been the messenger of good tidings to him. And Josephus, in another account, tells about that. And fell into the deepest sorrow. So he looked on this as an evil omen. Saw that owl, like the raven, you know. He saw sees the owl, and he says, uh-oh, this is bad news. A severe pain also arose in his belly and began in a most violent manner. He therefore looked upon his friends and said, I, whom you call a god, am commanded presently to depart this life. While providence thus reproves the lying words you just now said to me, and I, who was by you called immortal, am immediately to be hurried away by death. But I am bound to accept of what providence allots as it pleases God. I'm not sure that he spoke those words in exactly that way. This is Josephus' way of putting it, but I'm sure it had a little more, expressions of woe and pain in them. For we have by no means lived ill, but in a splendid and happy manner. When he had said this, his pain was become violent. Accordingly, he was hurried into the palace, and the rumor went abroad everywhere that he would certainly die in a little time. But the multitude presently sat in sackcloth with their wives and children after the law of their country and besought God for the king's recovery, probably because they thought that was their best hope at getting the food that their people needed. All places were also full of mourning and lamentation. Now the king rested in a high chamber, and as he saw them below lying prostrate on the ground, he could not himself forbear weeping. And when he had been quite worn out by the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed this life, being in the 54th year of his age and the 7th year of his reign. So what Josephus tells us here from his historical sources is consistent with what the New Testament tells us, that this man died a violent death, and he did so because the people were calling him a god, and he didn't rebuke them. He didn't give the glory to God. He took it for himself. And so he breathed his last, as it says here. Now there's a contrast. There's a contrast that we see here in the text. You notice that here was this man who was persecuting the church. He'd killed James, the brother of John. He'd imprisoned Peter. And now then he was seeking to appease the people and presenting himself before them as if he were a god. And they were calling him a god. And he gets struck dead. And yet, at the same time, look at the next verse, but the word of God increased and multiplied. So the one who was persecuting the church met an abrupt end. But what happened to those persecuted? They successfully continued preaching the gospel, in other words. The word of God increased and multiplied. And that means, of course, that the church continued to grow. That's what happens when a ruler decides he's going to take on the church that Jesus built. And then we read in verse 25, as we read earlier, and Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had completed their service, bringing with them John, whose other name was Mark. So now, from henceforth, from this point onward, we're going to read a fairly detailed summary. And that really, that's what it is, as a summary, but a fairly detailed one of the ministry of the Apostle Paul. Because he became, after the original apostles and laying the foundation of the church, he became one of its chief builders, I guess you could say, part of the foundation, and a very important part of that foundation, because he was called to this unique ministry. As he says in the book of Galatians, that they agreed, the people at Jerusalem, with them, with Paul and the people associated with him, they agreed together to, they extended the right hand of fellowship and agreed that Peter and the others would go to the Jews and that Paul would go to the Gentiles. And now then that the Jews, it seems that the message was penetrated the Jewish culture pretty deeply. And you had thousands of converts. And now then, as we've seen in past studies, that this is now moving on outside the boundaries of Judaism and the Jewish culture, and is moving into the rest of the world. And for this reason, then, the ministry, or the focus turns to Paul's ministry, because that was his primary responsibility. So we'll read, we'll continue next time with this next chapter, and we'll begin looking a little more closely at the extensive and the very successful ministry of the Apostle Paul.